In the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, TNI and its allies are working to continue to bring you radical analysis of the most pressing issues of the day. We bring together excellent experts to discuss how this pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how this crisis must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live with dignity. The following webinar looks at the trajectory and globalization of border militarization across the world, the history, ideologies, and actors that have shaped it, the pillars and policies that underpin the border industrial complex, the resistance of migrants, refugees, and activists, and the shifting dynamics within this pandemic. It asks whether there are ways post the pandemic to forge a different path that rejects inhumane border politics, welcomes refugees and migrants, provides full citizenship rights to the undocumented, and embraces the dignity of all human beings.
Good morning, good night, wherever you're joining us from. This is another of TNI's COVID Capitalism series webinars. Today's webinar is titled Walls Must Fall, Ending the Deadly Politics of Border Militarization. My name is Niamh Ní Bhriain from the Transnational Institute. For those of you who may have not have joined us before, Transnational Institute is an international activist think tank. We're based in Amsterdam, committed to acting as a point of connection between engaged scholars, progressive intellectuals, and movements, moving towards transformative change and social justice. And so to that end, we regularly publish new and cross-cutting research and organize events to develop collective analysis on key political moments of our time. And in that sense, this is why we have set up this series of webinars looking specifically at the COVID-19 pandemic and how that's affecting different aspects of our lives. If you want to subscribe to TNI's newsletter, which we hope you do, you can follow updates. You can also look back at the webinars that you may have missed, and they're available on our YouTube channel. And if today you're in a position where you may be able to make a donation to TNI's work, you can also do that through the links on your screen. So today, as I said, our webinar is being hosted by TNI, but also we're very happy to say that we have a number of co-sponsors that have helped in the outreach and support in preparing this webinar. So to thank Focus on the Global South, Alternative Information and Development Centre, AIDC, Asia Europe People's Forum, Transnational Migrant Platform, and Statewatch, who are our co-sponsors today. So thank you very much for your support. I'm also pleased to say that our webinar today is available in Spanish. So we have a wonderful team of interpreters who are making this available in Spanish. Antes de empezar, voy a dar una bienvenida a los que nos están escuchando en español. Muchas gracias por conectarse el día de hoy al webinario. Para acceder a la interpretación, pueden ver en sus pantallas los pasos que hay que seguir para poder acceder a la versión en español. Espero lo puedan encontrar. And now back to English. First of all, before we get into the dimension of borders that we'd like to discuss, I'd like to mention our speakers and welcome them to the discussion. So we have Harsha Walia, who's joining us from Canada, and it's 7 a.m., so a special thank you to Harsha, author of Undoing Border Imperialism. Todd Miller, who's a journalist and author of Empire of Borders, also joining us at 7 a.m., so many thanks to Todd. Jill Belisario, who's joining us from Amsterdam today, an organizer with the Transnational Migrant Platform Europe, and also Kavita Krishnan, who's joining us from India and from the All India Progressive Women's Association. So as each speaker intervenes, I'll give a more in-depth description of the work that they're doing, but just for now to mention our four speakers and to thank them for joining us. And the format of today's discussion will be that Harsha will kick us off with a 10 or so minute introduction, and then we'll hear from Todd, Jill, and Kavita, And then we go back to Harsha again. And also while the panelists are speaking, you can engage in the discussion through our chat feature, which is at the bottom of your screen. And also there's a questions and answers button. And my colleague Breed will be compiling all of the questions that she receives, and she will send them to me as the discussion is going on. So I can also, further on in the discussion, I can pose those questions also to our panelists. And also, if you're joining us and are using social media, there's a hashtag, which is TNI webinars. And you can also share your thoughts and reflections on the discussion there as well. So I think that's everything I need to say before I actually get into the issue at hand, which is borders and militarization. So I suppose just to mention that in TNI, we have been looking at the question of borders for a number of years now, particularly through our Border Wars series. And we've been asking a number of questions in the research that we've been publishing around how are we to understand the increased militarization of borders that we're seeing, looking specifically at the border security industrial complex. And we're asking how is this industry growing and who is benefiting from the growth of this industry. We're also asking to what end and to the detriment of who. We're also asking how are we to understand the tens of thousands of lives that are being lost every year in the oceans around the world, in the deserts across the globe. How are we to understand that we're allowing this to happen and that things are in fact getting worse? We're also going to try and draw some parallels between the failures of capitalism, the growth of migrant workers, and the precarity that we're seeing in labor, and to try and link these in also with border politics. We're also going to ask some questions around border politics and racism. So there are many, many fundamental questions. We will try and address some, perhaps all of different elements of those questions in this webinar, but also, as I said, we've been publishing a lot of research around borders in TNI in the last few years, so you can also access that at the links that we just put on your screen and in the chat as well. So to delve into the discussion, I'm going to introduce our first speaker. So we're delighted to have Harsha joining us. So Harsha Walia is a longtime advocate for migrant justice, Indigenous rights, equality rights and economic justice. She is an award-winning author and on Undoing Border Imperialism, co-author of Never Home, Legislating Discrimination in Canadian Immigration, as well as Red Women Rising, Indigenous Women Survivors in Vancouver's Downtown East Side. She's also active in social movements, including No One is Illegal and Women's Memorial March Committee. She is a graduate of the Allard School of Law at UBC. So Harsha, I'd like to ask you if you can take us a few steps back from where we are today and ask you to delve into the question of border imperialism and the systems that are bound up within that. How can we understand those systems today and in particularly within the COVID-19 dynamic? So Harsha, over to you and thank you very much for joining our discussion.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes. I can.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I just want to start by acknowledging that I'm here on unceded Coast Salish territory. So I'm on lands of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people. So these are the Indigenous territories that I'm located on here. And I think that's particularly vital because a lot of times immigration is seen as separate from Indigenous issues. And I won't have time to get into it, but they're fundamentally bound up in the ways in which we think through the creation of the nation state. I also want to just acknowledge and lift my hands up in gratitude and respect and solidarity to all of the Black-led rebellions that are happening today across the world, particularly on this part of the world where I'm based. And also to say that, you know, Black-led liberation movements and abolition movements are deeply connected to migrant justice politics and the politics of the border, again, often seen as a separate site of struggle. But Ronaldo Walcott and Idil Abdelahi remind us that the entire politics of migration is embedded in anti-Black logics. And so they write, for example, that movements that we now call migration are founded in anti-Blackness, taking their logic from transatlantic slavery, end quote. And that's from their really excellent book. And this isn't unique to this part of the world. Of course, we see that the entire organizing of the European border and the conceptualization in resistance to that through the theorization of the Black Mediterranean, for example, very much sees the ways in which migration is connected to anti-Blackness. So I just want to start off by saying that. And then to the question of taking a few steps back to conceptualize the border, you know, the first thing that I'll say is when we think about the border and we think about walls, we often think about these kinds of static structures, or in the case of the border, about a line demarcating territory. But I would argue that the border, and of course many others would too, that the border is actually far less about demarcating territory or even less about a politics of movement per se, right, when we think about migration, but that it's much more useful as a point of analysis to understand the border as a key method of imperial state formation, hierarchical social ordering, labor control, and xenophobic nationalism. So I'll just go through a few quick points. So the first of that is that borders are not fixed or static lines. So they're productive regimes that are constantly being generated and producing social relations of dominance. So to put another way, the border is elastic and that line can exist anywhere, not simply at what we imagine the border to be. So it can extend far within internally and far beyond the border externally. And this is very important, right? Because the one thing that walls do, of course, is they create the spectacle of the border as a static location. But really, border governance is increasingly internalized, which is we see border enforcement increasingly coordinated with, for example, policing forces, and also especially externalized. So externalized, for example, through the Remain in Mexico protocols in the United States. And this is also incredibly important because policies of border externalization are being perfected all around the world, right? So we have European border policies, of course, that externalize into the Sahel region to prevent migration across the Mediterranean, which, as we know, is already the world's deadliest border, or Australian policies of offshoring to detention to Nauru and Papua New Guinea. So, again, the border being externalized suggests that policies of border enforcement can exist anywhere. And I think this is also important for another reason, which is far less talked about, which is the ways in which imperialism is a key mode of border governance. So, you know, US, Australian, European, and many other countries and continents, subjugation of countries, for example, in Central America, Oceania, Africa, and the Middle East, compels countries in these regions to accept external checkpoints, to accept offshore detention, to accept migration prevention campaigns, to accept expelled deportees as conditions of trade and aid agreements. And so what we end up having is a situation where countries, including Libya, Mali, Mexico, Nauru, Niger, Papua New Guinea, Turkey, Sudan, and more, these countries have become the new frontiers of border militarization. And they're further dispossessed of their resources, with their lands now being used to build externalized infrastructures of migration control under racial imperial management. And so we already know that imperialism is, of course, already a root cause of global migration, right? So that the patterns of migration are asymmetric, the ways in which migration happens is asymmetric, who's called a tourist, who's called an expat, versus who's called a migrant, who's called a refugee. So we already know imperialism underwrites the causes of global migration, but I would argue that now that the very management of global migration through outsourcing is also becoming a means of preserving imperial relations. So migrants and refugees have become bargaining chips for, you know, authoritarians like Erdogan or Hometi. And so too, the kind of traditional pillars of imperialism like economic dependency, economic debt, military domination, etc., we can also add the soft power of immigration diplomacy as a central pillar in the maintenance of a colonial present. The second thing that I want to run through briefly is thinking through the conceptualization of the migration crisis, right? So the language of migrant crisis, or the far more right-wing language of migrant invasion, this is a pretext to shore up further border securitization and repressive policies. But what's particularly vital about this is such representations depict migrants and refugees as the cause of an imagined crisis at the border, when in fact mass migration is the outcome of the actual crises of capitalism, conquest, and climate change. So it's far more accurate to describe the migration crisis as a crisis of displacement and immobility, because we know the vast majority of the world's migrants and refugees and undocumented people are actually immobilized as a result of border securitization. And of course, what is most ironic about this, I find, is that the migration crisis is declared a new crisis with Western countries. And again, Western here as an expanding category as more and more countries, particularly India, becoming folded within imperial G20 politics. So as a new crisis with Western countries positioned as its victims, even though for centuries, 80 million Europeans became settler colonists across the Americas and Oceania, while millions of indentured laborers from Asia were scattered across the globe, and particularly in the South Asian context, you know, this is very much underwritten by caste and class. And the transatlantic slave trade kidnapped and enslaved 12 million Africans. And so colonialism, genocide, slavery, indentureship, all of these are conveniently erased as continuities of violence in the current invocations of a migrant crisis. And also, these are the very forces that are the conditions of possibility for the West's preciously guarded imperial sovereignty. The third thing, briefly, is that contrary to common analysis, borders being simultaneously monetized and militarized, which is, you know, the idea that they're open to capital but closed to people. This is a very common leftist formulation. These are not contradictory juxtapositions, right? So the free flow of capital requires precarious labor, which is shaped by borders through immobility. And again, those borders are often internalized. This is not just about the external border. We see internal migrants and internal migrant workers, if you will. So the free flow of capital requires precarious labor. And so in international talk, you know, this is increasingly the regime of managed migration and the concerted shift towards temporary labor migration, which unambiguously proves this requirement, right? So insourced labor from labor migration programs and outsourced labor in free trade zones, they're flip sides of the same coin. This is a bifurcation and segmentation of the global labor force made precarious through bordering practices. And so temporary labor migration, guest worker programs, you know, whatever name it takes in each national jurisdiction, this is essentially the legal tying of immigration status to employment, which turns migrant workers into a state-sanctioned pool of unfree, essentially indentured labor. And the state differentiates these workers as migrant laborers, whose labor power is captured by the border and then manipulated and exploited by bosses, right? So even as migrant workers are temporary, it's important to note that temporary migration itself is increasingly a modality central to state formation, citizenship regulation, labor segmentation, and segregated social ordering. It's becoming a permanent feature of our world. And so what does this mean in the context of the pandemic in the last minute that I have is essentially in the context of the pandemic, all of these forces are escalated. So the pandemic, like every global crisis before it, provides a perfect excuse and pretext to hasten the vision of securitized borders, usher in states of emergency into permanency. And you know, we have over 57 countries who shut down their border to people seeking safety. And there's many, many examples of that. People stranded in Malta, for example, and dying while being stranded in Bangladesh and Malaysia, refusing to accept Rohingya refugees, Hungary suspending admission of migrants, with the border with Serbia and more. And also we have, again, that kind of juxtaposition that while the essential movement, if you will, of refugees is being halted at the border, we simultaneously have deportation flights expelling people out. In the case of the United States, for example, the U.S. deporting people to Guatemala. And as we know that as of about May 2020, nearly one-fifth of all known coronavirus cases in Guatemala were deportees from the U.S., right? So exporting out, expelling people and exporting the virus to countries with weaker health and sanitation systems. So refugees not being allowed in, but deportees being expelled out. And parallel to that, while most visa processes are shut down, we have migrant worker visas. So particularly migrant farm worker visas are being churned out to ensure that a steady supply of cheapened labor for food supply chains is maintained, right? So again, we have all of these seeming contradictions, but that are not really contradictions, but a central function of border imperialist rule in the ways in which migration is increasingly a form of global governance. So to end, what I'd say is that if we're thinking through how to dismantle borders, it's so vital that we do that not through just looking at the site of borders and the ways in which border control is enacted at the site of territory demarcation, but we're thinking through the border really as a manifestation of imperialist capitalist rule, right? And as a form of racial capitalist rule. And so it's really vital that we think about it as really a symptom of these, as these larger forces, and that we're thinking through the idea of the freedom to move, the freedom to stay, and the freedom to return, right? So ensuring that no one is forcibly displaced, ensuring that people who are displaced are able to move, and that people are able to return to their homelands, right? Thinking here especially of the Palestinian and many other stateless people's right to return to their homelands being occupied. So I think those are some of the key kind of pillars to thinking through how to dismantle borders. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Hersha, for introducing those points to begin our discussion. I think our other speakers will probably come back to a number of those as we go through our webinar. So now I will hand over the discussion to Todd Miller. First of all, to introduce Todd. Todd is a journalist, and as I said earlier, he's the author of many books on border politics, including Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration and Homeland Security, Empire of Borders, the Expansion of the US Border Around the World. And Todd also last year researched and authored a TNI report, which is titled More Than a Wall, which examines the key corporate players involved in the militarization of US borders. So Todd, I'd like to throw the ball over to you now and ask if you can maybe bring us into the discussion around the corporate players involved in the border industry complex. How are we to understand the role of these players in borders? And also the question of the empire of borders and who are the drivers behind this? And if I can just remind you that we're being interpreted into Spanish, so if you can please speak just so that we can interpret at the same time. Thank you very much, Todd, and over to you.
Sorry.
There we go.
Perfect. Yeah.
Thank you, Todd.
Sometimes I can be like
early in the morning for you. So
yes,
no problem.
Yes. Barely here. Barely here. I'm kind of on the road right now too. But thank you so much. I really appreciate the introduction, and it's really an honor to be here. And I wanted to say, you know, listening to Hersha speak too, I always learn so much, and I think her book on doing border imperialism is one of the most important books I've read on the border. And right now I'm going to use my brief time to talk about the, as you said, the border industrial complex. I want to talk about it in a global sense, but first from a kind of US perspective of how it's manifested. In terms of, you know, how U.S. border enforcement has been fortified in the United States, and then how it's externalized. It might have to spread over two rounds of talking, but that's okay. Looking first at the United States, the border has been an issue in the United States since its inception. But I want to focus on the last 25 years. One thing I do want to say is that a lot of, especially within the United States, a lot of the focus on the border has been on the Trump administration, and which kind of erases what has been a long trajectory of border militarization that's been going on in the United States and externalizing from the United States in the terms of elasticity, as Hersha was mentioning. If you look in the US context of the last 25 years, you're gonna have the most massive expansion of the border apparatus, the border immigration enforcement apparatus that we've had, that the US has had in its history. And to give some numbers to how this has played out, when the annual budget for border and immigration enforcement for the United States in 1994 was $1.5 billion, and then last year, 2019, $24 billion. And those are annual budgets. So you can see just how it's an literally astronomical increase of budgets being put towards this enforcement. And I want to stress, beginning when you when you think about 1994 from the U.S. context, you're also thinking about the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. So that the kind of corporate globalization, and people who remember NAFTA remember that it was written by 500 corporations with no input from anyone else. And so it's been a kind of a mixed up in a corporate endeavor and an imperialistic endeavor since you know, in these 25 years that I'm discussing. And after 9/11, more it just became as a pretext to put more and more resources into this. And so when you look at this trajectory of the last 25 years, there are many manifestations that have happened. One is when Donald Trump took office, there was already 650 miles of walls and barriers built along the U.S.-Mexico border, for example. Billions and billions of dollars of technologies, and I'll get into those in a minute. Border patrol agents, armed border patrol agents, have gone from 4,000 to 21,000. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which is the parent agency of the U.S. Border Patrol, has become the largest federal law enforcement agency with over 60,000 agents. And all this is deployed in a way, and just speaking strictly to the southern border, I know there's more to the border than that, but speaking strictly to the southern border, has been deployed in a way that blockades people from going crossing the U.S.-Mexico divide through urban or traditional areas, and people are forced to circumvent into areas such as the Arizona desert or other deserts. And there have been at least 8,000 deaths since then. Most people estimate many more, up to 20,000 or more, because it deals with the remains of people who have been found. So as I look at, you know, this last 25 years and the increased budgets, there has been also a massive increase of private companies who have been participating in building the U.S. border enforcement apparatus and immigration enforcement, which includes immigration incarceration. One stat that kind of says it all to me in terms of how much of this participation has happened is if you look at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is ICE, and CBP, Customs and Border Protection, basically the Border Patrol, their contracts that were given out to private corporations between 2006 and 2018, there were 99,000 contracts, which amounted to $45.2 billion in US dollars. And that figure, $45 billion, would be the equivalent of 30 years of the total accumulated border and immigration enforcement budget in the United States between 1975 and 2002. So almost 27 years of accumulated budget going to private contracts. This, as part of the research that I've done, I've gone to all over the world to different places to go to different conventions and borders, what are called homeland security or border security expositions or expos and convention halls. And I've been to many in the United States and in the Southwest, but also in Washington, D.C. I've been to one in Mexico City. I've been to one in Tel Aviv and Israel, Palestine. I've been to one in Paris, France. So it represents a kind of global industry. And one of the things that is always so striking is going into any of one of these halls and see just the concentration of vendors and companies and all of it, it's like almost going into a feature imagination of what what industry and different governments are envisioning, what borderscapes are going to look like in the future. And it's just an array of like drones and robots and biometrics and facial recognition and high-tech cameras and just as in some places as far as the eye can see. And I always think, wow, this is what is being imagined, right? And in the United States, all of that, I mean, not all of what you see has been deployed, but a lot of it has. And that's one of the things that I really looked into in the More Than a Wall report with the Transnational Institute is the different companies that have been getting contracts. And the list is so long. As I just said, there was 99,000 if you look at ICE and CBP. Right now where I live in Arizona, there's a company called Elbit Systems is building what are called integrated fixed towers. Those integrated fixed towers were first deployed and experimented with, and that's their term, in the Palestinian occupied territories. And after 10 years of deployment there, then when CBP, Customs and Border Protection for the United States, was looking for surveillance towers, the Elbit system said, well, we have this, it's been proven in the world and in the most challenging borders in the world, right? So it's used as a selling point. That's just one example. There's Boeing Corporation has built a number of other towers. General Dynamics, I'm naming traditionally big military companies that have now are applying homeland security applications to their military technologies for borderscapes. We have drones by General Atomics. General Atomics is a shoot-off of General Dynamics, and their Predator B drones that the United States has used in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. So there's a sort of import of military technology as well. Biometrics, facial iris recognition. Northrop Grumman is another big company that just got a gigantic contract with CBP to do its biometric system, which is extending to the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala for what they call biometric kiosks. So when Mexican immigration officials, detain and expel people from Central American countries or beyond, they will go be put into these biometric systems that will then transfer to Customs and Border Protection. And then, of course, there's immigration prisons and the different prisons that like Geo Group and Core Civic, who also are infamously profiting, I believe, to the tune of $124 per bed per day of people detained and incarcerated. And so you put all that together, I think I might be out of time for this first round. Is that correct? You put all that together and there's Matt, you have this makings of an industrial complex with all these companies that I've met getting lucrative contracts, and then they're able to get into, you know, the policy makers offices in Washington, D.C., and really influence different committees and put tons of lobbying money into this. And really, it becomes something unto itself. And with that, I think I'll be quiet for now and resume at the second round.
Thank you very much, Todd. And yes, I remember in the report that you did with us, More Than a Wall, which I think that it was just shared now in the chat. I remember indeed that you described how it was to go to these fairs where there was all sorts of wares being sold, helicopters that would fly down and a scattering technique where people who had gathered would be forced to flee And then you showed the flip side of that, which is the people who were fleeing, and that they're, you know, people who were fleeing war-torn countries, obviously fleeing violence, including economic violence. And very often we're, you know, we see the one side, but we don't we don't often see the other side when we hear the discourse, I think, on mainstream media, at least. So thank you very much for explaining that, and you can read more about that in Todd's book that I just mentioned earlier, Empire of Borders, and also in the TNI report, I think, that was just shared now on the chat. So thank you, Todd, for those thoughts, and we will come back to you in our next round to continue. But now I'll move over to Jill Belisario. So Jill, to introduce you, first of all, Jill is joining us from Amsterdam also. Jill is an organizer with the Transnational Migrant Platform, which is a network of migrant and refugee organizations in Europe, and also an organizer with the People's Global Action for Migration, Development and Human Rights, and a member of the International Steering Committee of Civil Society at the Global Forum on International Migration and Development. And Jill is going to discuss a little bit more the question of border externalization, looking particularly at the question of Europe. So Harsha mentioned, of course, that the European, the extension of what we see as border imperialism, that European borders are way down into the Sahel in Africa. And so Jill is going to help us to understand a little bit more the dynamic of border policies in Europe and the Mediterranean Sea in particular. So Jill, I'll pass the give you the floor. Thank you, Jill.
Hi everyone. Thank you very much, Nii, for the introduction, and I'm glad to be part of this webinar, as it is a very important. I think the questions that are being asked here are very important to go forward in seeking justice, social justice for migrants and refugees. As Neve mentioned, I am part of the, I'm representing the Transnational Migrant Platform, which was set up in 2008 by self-organizations of migrants and refugees in several countries in Europe, who had a track record of working together on specific campaigns. And in 2008, responded jointly to the then proclaimed EU policy of zero tolerance for migrants and refugees. Fundamentally, migration has always been and always be a part of human development, and consider migration as a form of resistance to the inequalities and exploitative tendencies inherent in global capitalism. Therefore, in our perspective, the struggle of migrants and refugees needs to be seen as part of the global struggles for deglobalization and an end to the regime of capitalist extractivism, inequality, and injustice. Together with other social movements, we hope to develop a joint transnational strategy for advocacy, campaigning, and action grounded in multidimensional and intersectional narrative, and finding common ground. What is injustice for one is injustice for all. That's our perspective. So on the next slide, you will see the countries that have been closed within the free Schengen zone. During COVID, they have reintroduced the borders and also border controls, and it's very, I don't know whether you can see it, but according to the UNHCR, there was also a decline in people entering Europe. That's in the very left end. You will see a graph that is 2020 and 2019. So, and in Europe specifically, there is this normalization of extreme in a time of COVID-19. Many migrants and refugees living in the margins came forward to seek support for food, their health problems, and were threatened to be homeless, and also came forward because of bad working conditions and also exploitative working conditions. Several countries have used the virus as an excuse to suspend access to asylum. Populist politicians in Europe have sought to paint asylum seekers and irregular migrants as threats to the containment of the virus to bolster their long-standing push for closing borders and calling for people to be pushed back across borders or concentrated in crowded camps or detention centers. Since March, there have been reports of violent pushbacks of migrants and refugees. I think you have seen that The Guardian reported on Croatian police on the border with Bosnia. This while supervision of behavior of border officers had been the condition set on a larger grant of EU funds to Croatia. There was also reports about the Maltese government who has commissioned private ships to push the survivors back to the detention center of Tariq al-Sika, and also that the Greek authorities have been rounding up asylum seekers and migrants, illegally deporting them back to Turkey. Yes, as you can see, the emphasis on limiting mobility ostensibly due to COVID-19 could lead to an even stronger emphasis, and we think it, the externalization of borders, the constraint of mobility can indeed be the normal, the new normal, and the extremes can be the new normals. So going to the fourth slide, I thought, because I was also asked to explain a bit about the EU migration policy. I hope some of you will not be bored. I think that many in this joined are also experts on migration policy of Europe. But I wanted to share a bit the beginnings, no? In a sense, the policy, I'm sorry. So according to the policy papers, the main aim of the common immigration policy is to ensure the efficient management of migration flows, fair treatment of non-EU nationals residing legally in member states, and prevention of the enhanced measures to combat irregular migration and trafficking in human beings. The EU also accords particular importance to managing migration flows in cooperation with migrants' countries of transit or origin, and to strengthening the link between migration and development. The EU's common migration policy therefore has both an internal and an external dimension, and the EU, and as you can see in the left picture, it has actually three concentric circles. In the first and the smallest circle, you have the Schengen area. I think that everybody knows, maybe everybody knows, but it's the 26 countries within this zone recently have no border controls, and the residents are free to live, work, and travel freely throughout the Schengen. The Schengen countries implements a unifying asylum procedure called Common European Asylum System, including the so-called Dublin mechanism, obliging asylum seekers to file an application in the country of first entry in the EU. In the second circle, corresponds to the externalization borders, which was elaborated in the adoption of the Global Approach to Migration and Mobility, which represents the EU's overarching policy framework for political dialogue and cooperation on external migration policy. In 2015, this also included the setting up the hotspots and the introduction of temporary relocation schemes. So in the graph, we see this second circle stretches to the countries in the Mediterranean region, Turkey, Morocco, and Libya. You can also see in the right graph, you see the different places where the hotspots are currently and how many people they can have. So the third circle consists of countries further away from the EU that are migrants' countries of origin. In this circle, the externalization of borders reaches to the Horn of Africa, to Eritrea, Sudan, and Niger, for example. Current plan on migration pact is to elaborate this framework, and plans to pool all its development funds under umbrella of the NIDICI funds worth 89.2 billion. So almost finishing, beside Dublin regulation, externalization of borders, hotspots approach, the construction of Fortress Europe to regulate and control the movement of migrants also included the expulsion of non-EU nationals, the launch of Schengen information system, also the Europe-wide database and data exchange system, in, enabling the fingerprint and asylum seekers and the Frontex. After 9/11, the war on terror enhanced Schengen information system, also the visa information system. In 2015, the relocation scheme to take asylum seekers from Greece and Italy to Northern Europe was designed for nationalities with a 75% rate of successful asylum claims, an arbitrary threshold only applying to Syrians, Iraqis, Eritreans, and excluding everyone else from Africa. Its failure, the target was 160,000, but only 35,000 were relocated. This demonstrated the fault lines in the EU member states, signaling the rise in overt racism. Sorry, I had to... very fast. I hope I was. Yes, that's my input. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Jill. And I see as you were speaking, we had some engagement in the chat from Alarm Phone. So to recognize the work being done by Alarm Phone and by all of the others who are trying to monitor the situation in the Mediterranean in the absence of state protection, and doing the best they can to literally save lives every day as boats try and cross the Mediterranean. So in recognition of the work that's being done, and thank you very much for joining us today on this webinar. So now we'll move on to our final speaker in the panel. So we have Kavita. Kavita Krishnan is a communist feminist activist. She's a member of the Politburo of the Communist Party in India and secretary of the All India Progressive Women's Association, and an author with the most recent book called Fearless Freedom. So Kavita, thank you very much for joining us from India this evening. And I'm going to first of all ask you to try and address, I suppose, the question of border militarization in the context that is India and the broader region and the countries that share a border with India. If you can discuss this as a first kind of entry point, and then maybe to delve a little bit more into the question of racism and borders, because as we know, the Modi government has used COVID-19 crisis to intensify Islamophobic policies and practices and discourse. So it would be very interesting also to hear your thoughts on that. And then we'll come back to you in the second round for some of the other issues that we've discussed in the last few days. So this is the first round, and then we'll come back again. So thank you very much, Kavita, for joining us. Over to you.
Thank you so much. I'll get right to it. In South Asia in general, and in the Indian subcontinent, of course, in particular, there are many historic issues, the historic legacy of colonialism and conflicting borders. So the borders that India shares with several countries have a long history of conflict, and the situation of people living on these borders, especially in Kashmir, as well as in areas of the Northeast, the borders that India shares with Pakistan, with Bangladesh, and also with Myanmar, and also the situation with Sri Lanka. So the situation of ordinary civilians, this is not even about migrants, the situation of ordinary civilians living in these border regions has been extremely precarious, and they have been subjected to arbitrary detentions and arrests on both sides of the border. Simply, for instance, fisher people who are Tamil fisher people from India fishing in the waters between India and Sri Lanka, or fisher people arrested in Pakistan who are, you know, Indian citizens, and vice versa, farmers who are arrested just for crossing a border that they are not even sure exactly where that border is, between India and Pakistan. All of this has been happening on a big scale. With Bangladesh in particular, there are, of course, other issues as well. So the situation here in South Asia in general, and in this region in particular, is that there has been a lot of migrant as well as refugee movement, of course, for a variety of reasons. So, of course, that's also due to conflicts. Then it's due to oppressions of certain kinds of oppressed populations like the Rohingyas, and also, of course, a very high degree of economic migration, if you can call it that. So basically, people just going from lesser developed regions to more developed regions in search of work. The thing is that what you have in India right now is a right-wing government which has exacerbated the situation. It's a Hindu nationalist, Hindu right-wing government that has exacerbated the already existing situation of a militarized approach to this, to the borders, to the civilians living on the borders, to border conflicts, and also to civil migrant movement across borders. So what you have now is a government in India that has declared migrants who happen to be Muslim to be illegal immigrants. So this bogey of illegal immigration, so undocumented immigration being painted as illegal immigration, and that is actually being used to target not only those who are actually immigrants from, say, Bangladesh, but also those who are Indian Muslims, who are all being termed as potential illegal immigrants, because the issue of migration, immigration, is being used as an excuse to try and purge Muslims or strip them of their right to citizenship in India. That is a larger context. And then you have COVID-19 hitting. And you can imagine that what that situation has created. So you are having conditions right now where Rohingya refugees already in danger of being of arbitrary deportation and all of that. In the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, you have India's Home Minister actually ordering that Rohingyas be the aggressive contact tracing of all Rohingya people in Indian borders. Now, the reason for that is not medical, not out of a sense of care, but because there has been a communalization of the COVID-19 conflict, our COVID-19 crisis in India. So the Indian government has tried to blame the COVID-19 pandemic on Muslims and a particular Muslim religious event that was held in Delhi. So that has been blamed for the entire spread of COVID-19. And therefore, this demand that Rohingya refugees be aggressively contact trace. So contact tracing is actually a medical term, a term which is supposed to help people to identify those who have been exposed to the virus and help them. Instead, it is being used as a form of surveillance of Rohingya refugees who are being referred to indiscriminately as illegal immigrants. And in fact, the term which the government prefers is the term infiltrator. So the term that they use for Muslim immigrants of all shades, as well as of Muslims in general in India, is that they're all potential infiltrators. In fact, the term the Home Minister has used is that they are termites eating into India's body fabric, into the fabric of India. And in this situation, in COVID-19, you have situations where all workers in general, migrant workers, and we'll talk about that more in the second part. I hope I get to talk more about it. But just briefly, what you have is a massive situation of rural to urban rural to urban migration in India in general. So what the Indian government did was to impose this very top-down draconian lockdown in the Chinese fashion, in the Western fashion, without accounting at all, without giving migrant workers more than 4 hours to prepare. There was no prior warning that this lockdown was coming. And so when the lockdown came, you had millions of workers, the most precarious of workers in India, left stranded in various states. And if you're going to say stay at home, they naturally wanted to go to their home villages, and because they had no other way of surviving in the cities where they had come to work. So the Indian government did nothing to facilitate this. And so the enduring image of COVID-19 in India are the images of millions of workers walking home on foot, hundreds of kilometers, and dying en route, not from COVID-19, but from in accidents and in other forms of lockdown deaths, and being treated in inhuman fashion especially when they cross state borders. So each state inside India, most many of the states inside India have tried to do what we have been hearing about from Jill and others, where they are trying to say, okay, if a worker from another state, then we're not responsible for treating them even if they fall sick, even if they have COVID-19. Our hospitals can't deal with them. Our hospitals are going to deal with people from our state. So the federal structure inside India is being misused to try and strip Indian citizens of the right to access healthcare. And on top of this, with this whole Islamophobic, you can find right-wing portals and mainstream news media in India, which are basically propagandists for the far right in India, which is in power right now. They are running stories branding textile workers, garment workers in South India, say, who are stranded there and who are desperate to survive, as infiltrators, as illegal immigrants, as people masquerading as Indians when they're actually Bangladesh. And so this is an extremely disturbing situation which COVID-19 has exacerbated. The other point I want to just briefly touch upon before I end here is that just before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, you had India introduce, a few months before that, you had India introduce, the Indian government introduce a new citizenship law. The background for that, it's difficult to spell out in a brief, but I will be, there are links which I've shared with Nick. If Nick can share those links, then they're shared on email. You could share them here, that would be great. So explaining that basically there are situations in Indian states which share a border with Bangladesh, where after the formation of Bangladesh, and before that also, there was a situation of migration. And so there are Indian states in northeast of India which have concerns about their language and culture and so on. The unfortunate part is that the answer to trying to prevent some kind of subsuming of their language and culture, the answer was to go to the state with the issue and look for the most draconian ways to do this and the most inhuman ways of doing it. And so basically the issue became about trying to identify who is an illegal immigrant and asking the state to identify illegal immigrants and purge them. There's a long history to this. But with the current government, what happened was that this got a major sort of leg up. And so in the Indian Northeast state of Assam, you had this National Register of Citizen exercise, which left out 20 lakh people, 70% of whom are women. And you found, why? Because all people within Assam were asked to produce documents to prove that they were citizens. And naturally, the poor in India do not have documentation of any kind sometimes, and certainly not the kind of documentation that can prove that their ancestors are citizens of India. So you had this terrible situation already, and it was in the 20 lakh people that were left out, the Indian regime had hoped that a very large number of them would be Muslim. But what ended up happening was that a very large number of them were also Hindu, were Bengali speaking, both Hindus and Muslims, as well as people of other marginalized sections, and as I said, 70% women. And so in an attempt to create a sieve so that those who are left out of a National Register of Citizens exercise that they wanted to conduct all over the country next and make sure that the sieve could identify Muslims alone and strip them of citizenship while allowing non-Muslims an access, a route back to citizenship, the Indian government introduced this new citizenship law. And then there were all India protests against the citizenship law, which were met with violence, terrible violence by the police, as well as also violence against Muslims in the city of Delhi at the time when Donald Trump was visiting India around that time. And this was when COVID-19 was already a thing. And so what you have now after March, during the pandemic, during the lockdown, is the Indian government making use of the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdown, when people cannot mobilize for protests, to go after the Anti-Citizenship Act protesters. So protesters are being profiled as being criminals who were behind the violence in Northeast Delhi, and protest is being seen as proof of criminality. And you have a very large number of protesters being picked up during the pandemic and jailed. Human rights defenders, as well as very, very young students, including one pregnant woman student and a student activist of the Jamia Millia Islamia University. So I'll end my remarks there. We can always cover more ground later, but I think this is the situation right now. I'll just end by saying that what you have in India is a situation where, in general, the Indian state's policy towards dealing with borders and towards dealing with border conflicts, towards dealing with issues of like Kashmir, which are not just a question of a border conflict, but a question of the Kashmiri people and their right to have a say in what happens to them in their future. That all of that, the Indian state already had a policy of militarizing and dealing with in the most brutal ways. But now you have a situation with a Hindu right-wing government during a pandemic, which is making it much worse.
Great. Thank you very much, Kavita, for your words and for sharing that with us. And we will hopefully come back around. We have about just under half an hour left. So I'm going to go back to Harsha now, and I'll ask you, so I'm going to weave in one of the questions, because we did get a question in the chat early on. So I'll weave that in and also get some of your thoughts on what the other speakers have said. So we got a question which it looks at kind of the interconnection between Indigenous and Native peoples and border imperialism. So maybe you can discuss that a little bit and also respond to some of what the other panelists have mentioned in their introductions as well. Thank you, Harsha.
Sure, thank you. I'm tight on time, so I'll keep it brief. I think the ways in which we can think through the connections around Indigenous struggles and Indigenous land and borders are, well, several fold. I will start by saying that I think often that those struggles are pitted against each other. And we even see that in terminology, for example, to describe right-wing xenophobia is, just even the terminology for that is nativism, right? Which suggests that somehow the idea of a sense of belonging is antithetical to the right to movement. And those are pitted against each other when in fact, of course, right-wing racist xenophobia is precisely that. It's racism. It's not about Indigenous struggles and the right to belong. And so the right to belong and the right to move are often pitted against each other. But a lot of my work has focused on primarily organizing through those seeming contradictions. And I will say, that the main way that we resolve any of these seeming contradictions in the world is through struggle, right? It's through on the ground practice and relations. And so there are many things I can share. I don't have time for that, but I'd encourage people to look at some of the on the ground work that's happening to bridge migrant Indigenous solidarity and to not see them as juxtaposed. But in as much as I can think through that in this context, a few things. One is that an overwhelming number of migrants, particularly, and again, I'll speak here to the North American context, are Indigenous. So first of all, the very identity of migrant is a state-sanctioned identity. I mean, all identities are, but migrant really is. But Todd mentioned NAFTA. One of the things that we saw after the implementation of NAFTA, in addition to border militarization and, the general exodus to people impacted by the Capitalist Free Trade Agreement, was a very specific increase of Indigenous communities who became migrants, right? So that paralleled, of course, with resistance to NAFTA in Chiapas, in Guerrero, in Oaxaca, etc. That resistance is mirrored in the fact that a growing number of Indigenous people were displaced as a result of NAFTA and crossed the border. So the first is that we have to not erase or invisibilize the presence of Indigenous people within who we imagine migrants to be. Shannon Speed in the North American context has just written a great book looking at the experience of Indigenous people migrating. And she talks about it really as migration between different settler state structures, right? That it's migrants Indigenous people in Mexico differently, but similarly impacted by settler colonialism, Spanish colonialism, migrating to another settler state structure. So that's one thing. The other is that, of course, we see that the very creation of borders, and Kavita alluded to this, is imbricated through colonization, right? So the ways in which borders are arbitrarily demarcated, splitting up people arbitrarily, and again, the specific impact on Indigenous people whose lands are impacted now through an artificial border. The third is, you know, really thinking through and is, you know, much more abstract. I won't delve into it because, again, this is, you know, praxis on the ground, really. Is really about building relations and without simplifying and collapsing the ways in which Indigenous people and those who are deemed migrants have very different experiences, have different connections to the places, to where they are and where they're located and where they're moving. I think it is very important to think about the ways in which, again, going back to the idea of nativism, that we're thinking through these through power structures, right? So power impacts Indigenous people and migrants differently, but we're really working through a similar system of racial capitalism and imperialism. I think those are really key things to think about, and to not collapse the idea of migrant and Indigenous as inherently contradictory to each other. And that one is about moving and one is about staying, right? Those kinds of reductionist ideas of how power is playing out in the world. In terms of things to respond to, perhaps a few things that I'm thinking about. One is, you know, Kavita talking about what's happening in India right now, and particularly the crisis of statelessness. And I think it's really important, similarly, in the way, you know, this connects to this question about the relationship between Indigenous peoples and land and migrants and refugees, is thinking about the relationship between migration and statelessness, right? So again, oftentimes statelessness is seen as a produced crisis for citizens, and migrants are again seen as moving, but really they're on a continuum, right? So the same kinds of forces produce statelessness, you know, like Hindutva nationalism, like Brahminism, like Islamophobia in the Indian context. These are the same forces that are creating a produced statelessness of Indian Muslims, as are impacting migrants from Bangladesh, for example, and or Pakistan. And so I think when we're thinking about migrant and migration, that we include statelessness within that, even though one is seen as impacting citizens and one is seen as impacting migrants, because they emerge from the same racial social organization of the nation state. And really, I think that is the starting point to think about anti-migrant xenophobia. So again, returning briefly to the North American context, you know, and I alluded to this when I started, oftentimes Black liberation struggle, Indigenous struggle, migrant struggles are seen as separate. But really, if we look historically at state formation of the United States, for example, and Todd was, talking about the kind of recent ways in which border militarization has amped up and that it predates Trump. But if we go back even further, if we look at the historic formation of the US border, it is completely bound up in anti-Blackness and anti-indigeneity, right? So that the very architecture of borders came, for example, you know, I'll say this brief example. At the southern border, some of the first formations of Border Patrol, before the Border Patrol was formally created in 1924, were Klansmen and Texas Rangers, essentially white vigilantes, whose role was to ensure that enslaved Black people did not escape into Mexico. And so again, you know, thinking about how border formations really are imbricated through these more foundational structures, I think is important. And to not see these as siloed social forces. And the last thing that I will say, which is in the context of how we organize as migrant justice organizers, if there are people on the call, and I know that there's this is a very strong trend, and I'm responding here particularly to that one slide when we say things like migration is not a crime or migrants aren't criminals. In a lot of anti-detention work that I've been involved in, you know, there's this very strong, understandable inclination, for example, to say migrants have not been charged with the crime. I think it's really important that we think about not separating out, even as important as it is to highlight that distinction, but to also be clear that the entire prison industrial complex and the kind of carceral complex that imprisons people, whether they're political prisoners, whether they're charged under criminal law, whether they're charged as migrant detainees or under immigration law, and this is the connection, of course, to abolition struggles right now, that we try to not exacerbate those kinds of divisions that create those categories of deserving and undeserving or good or bad, right? So the idea that migrants being detained is bad, but the assumption there that the incarceration of other people is reasonable. So I think that it's important that we, as we're doing our work, that we think about how we're involved in broader social movements and struggles and articulating our struggles in such a way that doesn't, even if it doesn't intend to, doesn't reinforce other systems of punishment and control and state violence. So I think I'll leave it at that. I don't know how long that was, but I know we're tight on time. Thank you so much to all of the panelists for your incredible words. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Harsha. I know there was a lot of exchange in the chat on that question. So I'm grateful that you were able to address it. So thank you for that. I'm going to go over to Todd now because, I've two questions that I think I can maybe try and weave into one. And also, we are tight in time, so I'll see how you get on in answering them. So one question was kind of, it just mentioned, you mentioned Elbit and the way that border infrastructure was being tested, and I'm putting that in inverted commas, was being tested on Palestinians and then being exported elsewhere. And the kind of the notion of the outsourcing of borders and the globalization of borders. So I think that's very much linked into the work that you've done on the empire of borders. So maybe you can mention specifically the Palestinian question and the outsourcing. We have just under 15 minutes, so see how you get on with those massive questions in such small time. Maybe give it 5 or so minutes and then...
5 minutes, all right, I'll just...
Yeah, we'll see how you do.
I'll do my best.
Okay. Thank you, Todd.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question. I appreciate the question. And thanks to all the panelists. It's fabulous listening to everyone. In terms of... to Israel-Palestine and going to different places, one of the things that I researched there was actually looking specifically at the kind of global border industrial complex and how, and Israel has become one of the, the largest homeland security. There's a direct quote. I'm gonna have to paraphrase it, but like the homeland security capital of the world, meaning that there's more companies per capita that are developing homeland security technologies, I guess is one way to put it. That is first then quote unquote tested in often the occupied territories or along the different boundaries that around Israel or and then used to then export to different places around the world. And I use the example of the United States, but it's really, the exportation goes everywhere. And I looked at that in the context of the United States participation of this kind of the externalization of the US border, much like Jill was mentioning with the European borders externalization. There's a very similar context going on in the United States. It's been going on for a long time, but particularly fierce in the post 9/11 era, where you see, lots of resources and a distinct emphasis put on what they call it the extension of the border or pushing out the securitization or security, so the U.S. security, using that term. Excuse me. So in Empire of Borders, I went and followed the money around and just was astonished in all the different places. Like there's places like in the Caribbean, around Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Central America and Mexico, the Mexico-Guatemala border, the Belize border is an example, that seemed, you know, that you know, there's lots of money and resources going for the United States. I wish I could get into the details of how it works. I don't have the time to do it. But there's tons of resources, tons of trainings, tons of pressure from the United States for countries to these countries to like build up, fortify its borders. And then it just extends. It keeps going into and the Western Hemisphere and into South America, but also around the world. I ended up going to, you know, the Philippines and seeing like all the money that's going from the United States into the Philippines and how it goes into different companies such as Raytheon Corporation just built a big command and control center in the Manila Harbor for a $30 million contract. Or I went to the Jordan-Syrian border where the Raytheon Corporation also just got a $300 million contract to build up a border surveillance system between Jordan and Syria and Jordan and Iraq from the United States. So this is money coming from the United States, from programs of the United States. So those are just a couple of examples of this extension. But and just to summarize, the US border extension is kind of harmonized with the rest, like the EU's extension going on in other places. And when you look at the tally, right, when you start to the totality of this kind of global border system, it's astonishing. Like there's, if you just look at border walls in 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, there was 15 border walls, and now there's more than 70, and 2/3 of those were built after 9/11. Countless billions of dollars of technologies, hundreds of millions of like armed border guards now being deployed in places, you know, that, you know, the US externalization is a part of it, but it just breeds into this much bigger global border apparatus that, for lack of a better term in the time that we have, that is being deployed between a global south and a global north. And really, you know, it becomes, when you look at, you know, the idea of the analysis of border imperialism, right, you see that this there's a whole global system that's being put in place that is expanding far and wide, and it seems to keep one of the things it seems to keep is like an unsustainable, to use that term, an unsustainable world in place, a world where corporate globalization and capitalism and climate change and war is just displacing, you know, so many people, and for this kind of order of the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, the haves and the have-nots, there has to be some sort of militarized scaffolding that and one of the aspects of it is this global border military apparatus and I think my 5 minutes are up, so I will stop there.
Thank you very much, Todd, for squeezing so much into 5 minutes. And I think in the chat also there was some links which are also useful for anyone who wants more information on that. I'm going to skip Jill and come back to you in a second, and I'm going to go over to Kavita, because I think, so you finished your last point, you mentioned the question of protest and this assumption of proof of criminality and migrant workers who are protesting, and this links in with another question that we got in the chat. So anyone who does protest border control is accused of being a terrorist. Often. And so there's this kind of interplay between, if you question the state's border control, then you're a supporter of terrorism. So this is one of the questions that came through on the chat. We have less than 10 minutes. It's a huge question, but maybe you can say one or two things on this and what you wanted to wrap up on in 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'll go to Jill and close. So massive task, but I'll throw the ball to you, Kavita. And yeah, I think your mic is still muted.
Okay. Yeah, I'm so happy at some of the things that Harsha flagged, because they do speak in a very large way to the ways in which things are framed here in India, especially the bit about, you know, the right to belong being pitted against an indigenous identity being pitted against the right to movement and all of that. But what I meant was that it's criminalization of a variety of positions. So, of course, criminalization of migration in general, so you call them infiltrators and termites. By extension, you criminalize all Muslims inside India by implying that they don't really belong here, and all of them are migrants and are therefore criminal, therefore infiltrator, therefore termite, therefore not human. But also everybody who is protesting not both things, for the rights of Muslim citizens in India, as well as for the, against the militarization of borders, against the militarized dealing of conflicts like disputes like Kashmir or issues of migration from Bangladesh and so on, which there's absolutely no call to treat it as a military or a law and order problem in no way at all. All the people, all of us who criticize that are routinely termed as anti-national, are being threatened with arrest or actually arrested under a draconian law, which basically allows for arrest without trial and without bail for several years on end. So yes, I don't know if that really answered. There's a lot more to say, but I'll end my remarks.
And sorry, I will say, Kavita, my comments were to the question, not to you.
Your presentation was clear.
I know.
I just meant that I really appreciated what you said because it links up with the situation in Assam.
Absolutely.
And all of that, right? Like indigenous against, yeah. I knew that. I mean, I got you.
Okay, thank you. And I got what you were saying. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Kavita, for that. We have less than 5 minutes, so I just want to go to Jill to finish off. And I think I'm going to Jill to finish off because Jill has been very much involved in resistance. And I think it's very important to finish on a positive note. And I know that you have two slides prepared where you show the resistance of the Permanent People's Tribunal, and just maybe you can in 2 or 3 minutes sum up what you have been doing by way of resistance. And also while we're doing this in the chat, to share links where we can converge and find a way of pushing back against the border politics as they stand. So over to you, Jill, to I think you're still muted, Jill.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Niamh. And I hope I can finish within three. I think it's very clear now that in all the... Oh, sorry, before I go forward, I want to acknowledge Myron from Stop the Wall. They had a very successful ELBITS campaign, Stop the Wall campaign on ELBITS with 10,000 sign-ons. So I think it's very important to see that there is a lot of positive activism and resistance going on, and we are all coming together, hopefully, and with much analysis. So in our perspective, the conditions of migrants and refugees and immigration control are actually needs to be noted or needs to be recognized as system crimes, no? And it's within the Permanent People's Tribunal that we have been organizing, within the hearings and the sessions that we have been organizing with Permanent People's Tribunal, they have actually concluded that the immigration and asylum policies and practices of the EU and its member states constitute a total denial of the fundamental rights of peoples and migrants and are veritable crime against humanity, even though they may not be personally ascribable to individual perpetrators. According to commonly agreed criminal law definitions, they must be recognized as system crimes. And I think that this is the time, and we need, together with other movements, we need to, and as Harsha also was saying, it's important that the crimes that are committed within the concept of migration and border policies needs to be included in other movements as well. So yeah, within that process, actually, we had been able to hold 5 hearings in 5 cities in Europe. where we actually had 500 organizations who supported our call. One of the important elements that also came out of the session is that the mass deaths on the Mediterranean are actually is the result of the practice of a necropolitics, where the European Union and its member states regulate and control the movement and decides who is worthy. Achille Mbembe, a Cameroonian philosopher, was clear that necropolitics is more than a right to kill, but also the right to expose other people to death. In Europe, this has reduced a lot of people to precarious conditions of life. It was a very positive process in a way that migrants were not seen as category, but were part of a larger social issues, trade unions, peasants' organizations, domestic and care workers were also part and gave their, gave their testimonies on violations of rights. I think it's, let me end with, with the fact that we think that it's, I think that our biggest challenge currently, however, in Europe is finding the basis and strategy for convergence toward a sustained campaign that unites various strands of struggles. Too often the differences are hijacked, as Haisha also mentioned, but also here in Europe by rightist populist politicians who have even made their way into parliaments in several European countries. But there are many citizens and individuals and organization movements resisting alongside, and we are growing, so I'm very thankful. And you can see the photo here. This is the opening of our session in Barcelona. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Jill, for ending for explaining the resistance that's going on through the gathering around the Permanent People's Tribunal. And let me thank you, because we're nearly out of time. So I'd like to thank our guest speakers. So Harsha, Todd, Jill, and Kavita, thank you so much for joining us, especially from the US and from Canada at a very early hour in the morning. Thank you also, Jill and Kavita, for your interactions and exchanges, and the comments are in the chat that you can follow up on. Also, thank you to our co-sponsor organizations. So we have Focus on the Global South, AIDC, Asia Europe People's Forum, Transnational Migrant Platform, and State Watch. Thanks to everybody at TNI, especially Jess and Nick and the comms team for having supported the organization of the webinar. Thank you to our interpreters. Maybe just to mention, if you want to continue these discussions, there's another webinar starting at 6 o'clock this evening, which is being hosted by Sea-Watch, which will look at the EU-Libya collaboration. If anyone wants it half an hour or so, there's a link to that in the chat. Next Wednesday, we will be taking a break from our usual weekly webinars, but I'd like to invite you to view two others. So there'll be one on the 25th of June at 7:30 in the evening, which is being hosted by CAGE in the UK, and that's looking at exploiting a pandemic with the question of surveillance in COVID-19. And then there's another one on Friday, the 26th of June, looking at drug policy, so support, don't punish, the future of drug policing. And then we'll be back with our COVID capitalism series on the 1st of July, looking at the question of pandemics and people power, so tapping more into the resistance that Jill mentioned to finish our presentation. Again, if you're in a position to support TNI's work, you can find the link to make a donation at the bottom of the screen. I think that's everything from us. The chat will be open for the next 5 or so minutes if you want to wrap up your discussions there. And also the webinar will be available as a YouTube link on our YouTube channel if you want to watch it back. So I think that's everything from me. Just to thank again our speakers and everyone involved. And thanks to the audience for having tuned in. So muchas gracias. Adios.